Evansville, Minnesota, who dropped out of high school in the 11th grade and joined the Air Force at the age of 17. When he reached the barracks and asked for volunteers, saying that it was an emergency, nobody believed him. They all thought it was a prank. "All right," Sandaker said. "You call job control and ask them." Someone called and learned that Sandaker wasn't kidding. Airmen started throwing on their uniforms and hurrying to the PTS shop, not because they had to go, but because it felt like the right thing to do. Their buddies at 4-7 needed help. PTS Team B was assembled from a makeshift group of volunteers, the guys who were gung-ho. They gathered things that might be needed at the site. Refco suits, air packs, dewars filled with liquid air, tool kits, radios. Their team chief, Technical Sergeant Michael A. Hansen, told them to assume that nothing at 4-7 could be used and start from scratch. The PTS shop was a converted aircraft hangar, big enough to hold a few Titan IIs, with smaller rooms devoted to specialized tasks. The men of Team B loaded their gear onto half a dozen trucks, eager to leave, like reinforcements coming to the rescue. In addition to the PTS team, a flatbed truck with about 450 gallons of bleach and a tractor trailer with about 5,000 gallons of mineral oil were sent to Damascus. The bleach could be used to neutralize rocket fuel and render it less explosive. The mineral oil, dumped by hose into the silo vents, might form a layer on top of the fuel, trapping the vapors. The baby oil trailer, as some people called it, was brand new, and nobody had ever tried using baby oil to prevent an explosion at a Titan II missile site. Elsewhere at Little Rock Air Force Base, the Disaster Response Force was getting ready to depart. Its commander, Colonel William A. Jones, was also the base commander and head of the 314th Combat Support Group, a squadron of cargo planes stationed there. Jones was new to Little Rock, having arrived just 2 months earlier. He had not yet taken a disaster control course and didn't have much experience with Titan II missiles. His cargo planes were part of the Military Airlift Command, the missiles were part of the Strategic Air Command, and although both commands shared the same base, their missions rarely intersected. The Disaster Response Force was supposed to handle any military emergency, large or small, that involved units at Little Rock. During his brief tenure as its commander, the only emergency that Jones had faced was a search for the missing tail gunner of a B-52 bomber. The tail gunner had ejected from the plane by mistake, afraid that it was about to crash. The B-52 landed safely, as did the tail gunner, whose parachute was easily spotted floating above the Arkansas River. After hearing about the problem at 4-7, Jones decided not to recall the entire disaster response force. In his view, a disaster hadn't happened yet. The force didn't pack any gas masks, toxic vapor detectors, radiation detectors, or firefighting equipment. Jones did, however, bring a press officer to deal with the media and a Judge Advocate General, JAG, to process any legal claims filed by neighbors of the missile site. At about 9 o'clock, the dozen or so members of the force left the base in a small convoy. A few of them rode in the mobile command post, a pickup truck with two rows of seats and a camper shell. A bioengineer traveled in a van that carried equipment to monitor the vapor from a fuel leak. A physician and two paramedics followed in an ambulance. And the press officer joined Colonel Jones in the base commander's car, along with the JAG, who brought his disaster claims kit. Sid King stood in the dark beside the live ear. It was parked on the shoulder of Highway 65, overlooking the entrance to the missile complex. A camera crew from KATV was on the way, and reporters from the other Little Rock television stations and local newspapers weren't far behind. Nothing much seemed to be happening. The white cloud was still rising from the complex, but nobody appeared to be dealing with it. About a dozen men in Air Force fatigues were hanging around a blue pickup at the end of the access road. A security policeman sat in the cab, talking to the command post on the radio. And a helicopter hovered overhead, shining its spotlight toward the ground, looking for some place to land. The missile combat crew was glad to be outdoors, with a good half a mile between them and the silo. The night was warm, help was on the way. Everybody had made it out of the complex, safe and sound. The problem with the missile hadn't been solved, but the mood was calm. Then Rodney Holder looked up and saw that the helicopter was about to hit some power lines. The pilot couldn't see them in the dark, and the chopper was descending straight toward them. Holder started to yell and wave his arms, and then Mazzaro, his commander, noticed too. "Tell the helicopter not to land," they both shouted frantically to the security officer in the pickup. "Tell it not to land!" In an instant, Holder had gone from feeling chilled and relaxed to being absolutely terrified, convinced that the chopper was going to hit the power lines, spin out of control, and explode. It didn't. At the last minute, the pilots saw the wires, dodged them, and landed safely in a field near a farmhouse on the other side of the highway. Morris and Kennedy climbed from the copter and joined the men waiting on the access road. While Mazzaro spoke to the colonel about the accident, Kennedy and Holder discussed what should be done next. Kennedy didn't think much of Mazzaro and couldn't believe that his crew had abandoned the complex. But Kennedy got along with Holder. The two had taken some college classes together at the base and felt a mutual respect. They disagreed now, however, about whether there was a fire in the silo. Kennedy decided to see for himself. He asked Colonel Morris for permission to enter the site, and to bring David Powell, the airman who dropped the socket, with him. Powell was one of Kennedy's closest friends in the Air Force. When Kennedy was a PTS team chief, Powell served as his right-hand man. Kennedy could count on Powell to do just about anything. He used Powell to train new PTS technicians, and Powell hoped to become a team chief himself, maybe a non-commissioned officer. Powell was always calm and reliable, but now he seemed anxious, agitated, upset. After the helicopter landed, Powell had run up to him and said, "Jeff, I fucked up like you wouldn't believe." Powell added another detail. Not only had he dropped the socket, but he'd also used the wrong tool with it. A recent technical order said that a torque wrench always had to be used when tightening or loosening a fuel cap in the silo. The torque wrench ensured that a precise amount of pressure could be applied to the cap. Earlier that evening, Powell and Plum had reached level 2 of the silo, fully dressed in their